Right, that is a great song, isn't it? Yeah. Hey? And don't we all have that choice? Hey, go your own way or do what the Lord says. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. I started last week in the evening meeting talking about discipling leadership 101. And from time to time, I may have got a little bit strong. I don't think so. But I may have. One never knows. Is this thing on Facebook Live? All right, so to everyone watching, hello. Just for you guys who are watching, some miscreant in this meeting just now commented on my apparently creased shirt. It's meant to look like this. And this is just for anybody stuck with OCD in this place who wanted to take my shirt off and iron it for me. It's meant to look that way. Okay, we square. All right, so I'm doing a series where I'm wanting to look at the subject of discipling people. How do we disciple? We're meant to disciple. It's a core element of the Christian faith. As a matter of fact, I think besides loving God, it's the thing Jesus wants us to be best at. It's the thing that very few of us do well. I was in Secunda with Derek and Heidi Chester Brown at Lighthouse Church. We had a wonderful weekend, ordained some elders for them. Great meeting, great church, a lot happening. One of the things you spoke about was a guy who I'm going to meet in May. I'm looking forward to it. Who is a doctorate, a PhD on church planting and disciple making. As a matter of fact, when Dr. Yonggi Cho heard of his stuff, Dr. Yonggi Cho invited him to be on his board of directors immediately. He's based in Melbourne, and through conversation yesterday, I arranged a meeting with him in the month of May, and I'm intrigued to spend a bit of time with this guy to learn from him. Dr. Cho himself has handed over his small churches. He doesn't have time to do any ministry into his small churches. So any church under 20,000 people, he just does not have the time for those pastors, just so you know. Medium churches, up to 100,000, he's willing to do conferences with every now and then. You know, between their campuses, they run 1.2 million people per Sunday in South Korea, in Seoul. And this guy sits on his board. And so this friend of mine was at a meeting with a whole lot of big shot pastors, and they were having conversation, and this question was raised by him. Right, all of you, tell me who you are and where you're from. Right, quickly, starting on this end, going to that end, I want to know your strategic disciple-making program. Go. And they all kind of looked at each other within that particular group. Give me your strategic disciple-making program. They couldn't do it. He said, isn't it funny that the one thing Jesus told us to go and do, churches don't focus on. So we have people who want to know a whole lot, who want to whatever, whatever, but do not even know what it means to be a disciple. So obviously, I may change all my notes after meeting with this guy in May. All right, let's just put it out there. But for now, I'll go on what I feel God is saying, and we'll go from there. Don't we want our lives to count? Don't we want to look back one day and say that we made the biggest difference possible with our own lives? Surely most of us want to commit ourselves to something significant. Some of us, I believe, have this feeling deep inside. We want to make a difference in the world. We want to leave a mark. We want to leave a lasting legacy. It's a longing for significance, to do something with our lives that's going to go beyond us. Smallest funeral I ever did, I remember I was asked to do something at Doves in Wilmot for someone in an old age home. I don't do those anymore, but I used to. And I remember being at one where there were about 8, 9 people in the room, and I think 3 were staff and 1 was from Doves, and another, probably 4 or 5 people at the most, came to honor that person's life. It's not enough. It's not enough. I believe some of us want to make our lives count, but this desire we have to serve God gets distorted and gets hijacked because of temptations in this world. You see, making disciples is far more than a program. It is literally the mission of our lives. It needs to define us. I want to stay right up front that a disciple is a disciple maker, or that person is not yet a disciple. Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples. Hence, a disciple makes disciples. I'm a disciple. Well, I'm a follower of Jesus. My question to you, sir, my question to you, ma'am, is when I look over your shoulder, how many of those, as we sang tonight, how many of those have laid their lives down for the cross like you did? Because these truths are caught, they're not taught. I personally cannot follow somebody who's not sold out to the gospel of Jesus. I couldn't do it. But what stuns me is I'm able to spend time with people who are not sold out for the gospel. It's a convenience. And I want to tell you, those who have inspired my life, who press me to go forward, those I emulate are those who have given their lives for the sake of this gospel. But I also want to tell you, this gospel always is only one generation away from extinction. If everybody we know who's a Christian just doesn't raise up somebody else, Christianity's dead. In the next 50 to 100 years, billions of people right now have the faith, will be gone. This faith is propagated. You will see there are churches of thousands, but there are a few who propagate the faith. Many are simply hangers on. And we want to deal with that over this time. A disciple is a disciple maker. It has to define us. Well, I'm called to business and this is my vocation. And this is, whatever it is, I want to tell you, Jesus said to you to go and make disciples of the nations. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter what you do from 8 to 5, you've been called to be a disciple maker. God, in his wisdom, has just arranged it that for many of us, you work in a context where the devil has to pay your salary to serve Jesus. Right? Because that's how it works. The wealth of the wicked is stored up for the righteous. So we've got all the poor fruitcakes sitting saying, well, oh God, if the money, you know, the wealth of the wicked is stored up for the righteous, here's my bank account. Won't you send it to me, Lord? I'm the righteous. How do you think Satan hates it every single month having to pay salaries into Christians' accounts who are serving God in his domain? And he's funding it because that's how clever God is. Think about it. And even your tithe, oh God, you've given me up. I lay my money down at the altar. I give what you've given. You're giving that money from the principalities of darkness because there are no money trees. And this world is under the sway of the evil one. And God has made sure that the devil pays to have the gospel preached every day. It must gall him. Have you ever thought about that? It's only when you've got your money, I don't have enough to tithe, I don't have enough, I've been living, I'm holding it back, then you're serving the devil's purpose. But up until then, in your generosity, you're serving God. Matter of fact, just as an aside to our serving teams, you know this thing where we hand the offering bowl around all politely every week? Pass it on. Won't you put? It's over. It ended this morning. Sorry, tonight. As of next week, Natasha, I hope you're listening. I want bowls here in the front. In the last song, you're going to bring your offering. And you come in and give. You're no longer going to sit there and say, pass by. We're going to be a generous church. And part of our worship is going to be our giving. And we're going to lay down and say, Lord, this is yours. I'm showing the world who I belong to. I'm arranging my life and my finances around who I belong to. I'm going to be generous, Jesus. Thank you for the silence. So some of you are trying to compute what just happened. How did Jesus look and see the widow putting her two mites in if he wasn't sitting at the box where she came to bring it? Or do you think Jesus watched the boxes that went around the synagogue? Because remember, women aren't allowed in the main place anyway. He's sitting watching in the temple. It said he was watching who puts what in. I'm telling you now, even when you hand that little thing around, he's watching. I think he isn't. The Bible says so. I'm talking discipleship. Now you're all quiet. Yeah, check. This is a great evening. I'm only warming up. What are the four temptations that are thrown at us? Every person who puts his hand to the plow, who bails again, is one of these four. Number one, the performance temptation. I've got to make my life count, so I do it through accomplishment that others can recognize and endorse. Performance. Sorry, I can't get you, Greg. Work. You don't understand how much work requires me. I need to take time off from church. This has been so hard. I need to take a bit of a break, bud. I'm just curious. Have you ever taken any days off in the work week? Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. But I haven't seen you for 3 weeks and I need a rest. Yeah, God never gets your best. Pharaoh does. Because you're stuck on some performance wheel trying to please who exactly? The whole point of tithing is you've got to trust God that you can do with 9/10, giving him a tenth, than what you could do with 10/10. Exactly the same as Sabbath. That's why you have a rest. You've got to trust God that with 6 days you can do what normally would take 7 when you rest and you do what God's called you to do. I'm telling you, I don't understand a single Christian who ever says, I'm so busy I need to take time off from Sunday, but I give the devil Monday to Saturday. There's something wrong with this picture. I hope you're listening to me. I'm on the performance treadmill. Let me ask you this question if you're on the performance treadmill. When have you done enough to accomplish? What accomplishments have you done enough to impress people? When's it enough? When are people going to look at you and say, wow? Then, if you get the wow, what do you do with it? Do you play it again on your cell phone? Someone going, wow. And then, how long does the wow last for? Yeah, I'm asking a real question. The performance temptation. Second one, the comfort one. Do everything you can to avoid pain and discomfort. You'll have a great life. A life of little or no cost to avoid any unnecessary inconvenience. Having a life as comfortable as possible. You see, with some people, serving in the church is an unnecessary inconvenience. But we'll happily pour our life out for our own stuff. There are people who bless God with half an hour, an hour's attendance once a week. But give them a hobby or give them something that they're good at. And watch how many hours they pour into something that's not going to change a single person's life. But hey, bud, would you like to come serve in the church? Is there any, I can't commit, you know, my priorities, my diary. You have succumbed. Yet, there is this desire in you to count for God. But you're stuck in a place where it's either performance or you're onto comfort. I used to be in this church. It was wonderful. But you know, that other church offers a little bit more. That's why I'm going there. Well, I want to tell you, there's not a church on this planet that can offer what a good hotel can offer. Why don't you just go there? I'm being honest. The beds are more comfy. The food's better. The waiters are better. You're in charge. I mean, you pay your tithe there. You might as well go pay it there. Just be honest. Go and enjoy a bit of comfort. I don't know what you do with nail-scarred hands. We'll get onto it maybe tonight, where Jesus talks about those who would follow him and the lifestyle of one who follows. And there are some in the church doing everything in their power to make sure church is as convenient as possible. Number three, the money temptation. Earn as much as you can. Save as much as you can. A legacy is about financial security. I want to ask you, what has happened to faith and kingdom principles? What has happened to sowing and tithing and generosity as being part of our financial planning and our budgeting? If I can't get to the nations, am I sowing to the nations? Am I taking of my finances every month as a good steward and saying, I give first to the Lord and then to others? Have I budgeted my life in such a way when it comes to purchase this or do this, does it interfere with what God first put in my heart? If it does, it will not be allowed to rob me. Sometimes God can bless us with something that we then, by paying it off, robs us of what the generosity we know God's called us to. When is the last time God called you to give something that caused you to panic? Just asking. When's the last time you had so much? 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's your food from your mommy in your lunchbox. And someone came and said, hey, Jesus needs that. Eugene, it's not enough. Ask someone else. Not knowing that thousands are going to be fed by your act of generosity. When was the last time we decided, actually, my money's not mine? We're just waiting for counsel. As soon as those buildings are finished there in terms of they said 10 more days, that when I was told that, I think it's about 8 left now, and then our facility for training is going to be beautiful. We're going to put it on the screen. We're going to do a walkthrough. Immediately, we've got our next plans for our children's church. We're building 12 new classrooms, 2 halls. We're going vus. For those watching, that's big. Energetic. On the main road, we're putting facilities up that's going to make every kid in Edenvale drive past and say, I want to go there. As soon as we finished with that, we're doubling this building. Who's paying for it? You. Come on. Come on. I reckon there would be 10, 20%, 30% of our church living in a home valued at between 2 and 4 million rand. If we build a building and we take some properties, knock them down for parking, let's say 6 million. There are people in this church that have 6 million rand homes and more. And they pay for it themselves, one person. I'm going to ask 1,800 people together to buy one house. 1,800 people to buy one house together. Let's all chip in and buy it. That's in a sense what I'm asking for. Bigger facilities to do more, to get, and all it takes is kingdom principles. When's the last time you panicked when God said, this is what I want from your finances? But when the money principle goes, now I budgeted. This doesn't work for me. You see, what we have belongs to Jesus. And I promise you, when you think it's too much yours, he'll tell you to give it away. And he'll unsettle you until you do. Number four. This is the quietest this place has been in I don't know how long. The performance temptation, the comfort temptation, the money temptation, lastly, the pleasure temptation. I only live once, I'd better live it up. FOMO, fear of missing out. I've got to make that bucket list. The emphasis is on self. I don't want to deny myself whatever I can possibly get or experience. Funny thing is, those things normally take us away for weekends. And I'm not having a go at anyone who has a holiday home. I am saying just be wise about when you use the thing. Don't ever allow a blessing from the Lord to keep you away from the Lord's work. Ever. Ever. All the devil, not God, all the devil has to do to derail you from his call in your life is simply give you a blessing that you're stupid enough to accept. What are you talking about? Well, you need a bit of extra cash, so you're offered a job of 10,000 rand more a month, which after tax is 5.5. You move your family, you move your home, you move cities. You do everything for that money. But I want to tell you, someone once said, there's no such thing as a free lunch in this world. If someone's going to give you more, the only time anyone gives you more is when they want more. And if you haven't heard God on this thing, what will happen is you'll give of yourself into a place where you suddenly say, I can't serve God anymore. I've lost my family. I've lost my church family. I've lost what I'm supposed to do, but I do have a bit of extra money. And I'm telling you, 10 times out of 10, they blow that money on themselves, on something else that suits them. The Son of Man did not have a place to lay down his head. Four little temptations. And although they want to follow Jesus, many Christians have been subtly seduced by these temptations. Do you know I'm only on point one of my introduction? And I've given no scriptures yet, and I'm 16 minutes into this. Lord, help me. Every now and then, we suddenly have these magnificent moments where we see God expose and shatter these illusions. The pulling down of strongholds, the demolishing of arguments, where all of a sudden God wakes people from their slumber, their lukewarmness. They become gloriously disillusioned with the things of this world. It's empty promises. It's shallow amusements. And suddenly they begin to say, this Christian life can be richer. This Christian life can be more meaningful. I'm telling you now, if you're already saved, your Christian life is measured in people. Not in things and not in miraculous acts. Your Christian life is measured in people. Let's be those. Let's be those that want the things that matter most. Let's want our lives to count for the things of God. You see, the will of God is not something you add to your life. It's a course you choose. You need to be deliberate about it. We either line ourselves up with the Son of God that we're going to celebrate next week when it comes to the Passion Weekend. We either line ourselves up with the Son of God or we capitulate to the principles I mentioned just now. It's only one of those two options. Somebody once said, all who are called to salvation are called to discipleship. No exceptions, no excuses. Three questions I want to ask you quickly. What is the great pursuit of your life? What gets you up every day? I'm talking to people who are sitting here tonight because you want to be a disciple maker. You want to count for the Lord. What is the great pursuit of your life? What is that thing? Number two, what story do you want your life to tell? Because all of our lives tell a story. Do you know people watch your life? Preaching this morning at Lighthouse, Derek introduces me. And so it's a big church. Introduces me and he says, Greg, we know you've been through some stuff. He says, but I want to tell you that us and others have been watching your life closely to watch how you walk through those things. You see, your life tells a story. Your life. You cannot often avoid what happens, but you can dignify what happens by allowing your life to tell the story that keeps the great pursuit right in front of you. If you do not have a great pursuit, you will be pulled to and fro, to and fro. Circumstance will dictate your life rather than the call of God. You know what the problem comes in? When you haven't allowed the call of God to anchor you, no matter what it is, this call to discipleship, if you haven't allowed that to anchor you, circumstances start to define your future. And from that day on, everything is an excuse. Yeah, but look. I promise you, most of the things that happened to us, most of the things that happened to us wouldn't have happened if we kept the main thing, without any distraction. And that's what Jesus is calling us to. We'll get to some texts, I hope. We need to get to some texts. The second thing he did was a bit of a faux pas. He said, I'd like to introduce you to Vanessa, Greg's fiance. I said, no, yeah, that's what he said. I'd like to introduce you to Vanessa, Greg's fiance. We both like, whoa. Hang on a second. What's this? I'm still waiting for her to propose. That was a bit embarrassing. You try to cover that one up. And I'm like, fiance, where? Who? Number one, what's a great pursuit of your life? Number two, what story do you want your life to tell? Number three, how do you want to be remembered after you're gone? How do you want to be remembered after you're gone? There are funerals people go to where the reason that people went to funerals is to make sure they're dead. Why do you think people have an open cast funeral? I want to make... Get your pin at the door. Poke. They don't move. Okay, you can bury them now. That's why we often have cremations. The last thing you want is this one coming back. There are those who, when they die, others look and they're just devastated. How am I going to care? Etc. You know what I mean? How do you want to be remembered? I would like to be remembered by those who have followed Christ and done great things for Christ because of my influence on their lives. That's what I want. I don't know what you want. And how we answer these questions will control how we invest this one life we have to live. And so we have to pray and ask God to persuade every single one of us to give ourselves wholeheartedly to the greatest cause on earth, being a disciple of Jesus who makes disciples. Everything else is going to fade to black. Every other movement has an expiry date. The only revolution with eternal implications is the one Jesus launched. I believe when all is said and done, the quality of our lives will only be measured by two questions. Number one, was I a disciple of Jesus? Number two, did I help make disciples of Jesus? Our achievements, our comforts will be long forgotten. Our generous moments will be remembered. But only the causes that contributed to others' eternities will matter. Our money will have no value. Our pleasures will be gone. The items on our bucket list that have nothing to do with knowing, trusting, following, treasuring, and proclaiming Jesus will look absolutely stupid. What can make our lives different is an unwavering commitment to follow Jesus. His life was filled with purpose, with mission, and with eternal impact. His life was so remarkable because of his unwavering commitment to reaching lost people and making disciples. Jesus literally poured his life into the mission of redeeming humanity. And interestingly, Jesus poured his life into this mission and only raised up a few men. Many followers, many he fed, many crowds, but he gave himself to only a few. Just a few people. Then he commanded them to do the same to others. And in so doing, he started a revolution that changed world history. Rick Warren said, you cannot fulfill God's purpose for your life while focused on your own plans. You cannot fulfill God's purpose for your life while focused on your own plans. Somebody else, I'll get to it next time. Someone else said this. You can do more with 12 disciples than you can with 1,200 church attenders. You can do more with 12 disciples than you can with 1,200 church attenders. So what I thought I'd do in my own time was I thought I'd look to the gospel. Turn to Matthew chapter 9, please. I said we've got to go to the Bible. Matthew chapter 9. Can I ask if you're the Sunday night lot? The scriptures will be up behind me, but can I ask you, bring yourself a Bible, please. Bring a Bible to church. Make it a discipline. This Bible was given to me by Yannis. I just want to look how many years ago. This particular one. I've got a few. The 8th of January 2008, that's 11 years ago, he gave me this Bible. This is what Yannis said to me. Greg, thank you so much for all your time, input, and passion for God. Thank you for your life given so that me and Alette, along with others, can have the benefit. Thank you for being a friend, and I trust this Bible will only get or keep your passion for Jesus burning stronger daily. I love you, my bro, Yannis. 8th of January, 2008. And I've read this Bible along with a few others almost every day since January 2008. And I want to tell you, there's nothing like taking your Bible and bringing it with you. If it means you've got to carry a little bag around with you, well then so be it. If it means you've got to put it under your arm, so be it. Please don't always rely on electronic media. It's not the same. It has its place. I have one. You can make notes, annotations. I've got my iPad. Almost every note I make here, I make into my iPad. But I want to say to you, having the word, having this text in front of you is beautiful. Have it. Allow God to speak to you. You know why? When you open the text and you've highlighted things, memories come flooding back of moments when God gripped you. So take my advice. Don't just underline scriptures because they're interesting. The whole lot's interesting. Underline those passages where God takes his fist and hits you right in the solar plexus and you knew you just had a God moment. Underline those. Not the interesting parts, because it's all interesting. And you will page through that Bible and memory upon memory, faith upon faith will flood into you as you look at those passages and you honor what God does. Matthew chapter 9. From verse 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him. You see it there? Follow me, he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. In my Bible, I underlined those words. Follow me, he told him. Five words. I underlined those in yellow in my Bible, put a little one. At the bottom, I put my little one and I gave what I felt God saying to me. So the verse said, follow me, he told him. I said at the bottom, Jesus doesn't give suggestions. Follow me, he asked so politely. Follow me for the benefits. Follow me and make me. Follow me, he told him. We don't give each other the right to do that anymore. Who are you to tell me what? I do what I. Jesus walks past, says, follow me. What does Matthew do? He got up and followed him. There's the disciple right there. Do you see how short that verse is? No nonsense. We spent 20 years trying to turn our friends into disciples. And they still don't do what Jesus wants. And in Matthew 9:9, as Jesus went from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. Stop, pause, think about what just happened there. If you're serving as a tax collector, in the name of Rome, you're fleecing your own people. It's like Zacchaeus. You're dead to the world. Do you know that in certain villages in Israel, when you announced that you'd been made a tax collector, working with the oppressor, they would have a funeral and carry your cask and bury it. And from that day, no one would talk to you again. That's why when Zacchaeus was up the tree and Jesus said, Zacchaeus, I must eat with you today. It's the first time his name had been heard in a long time. Because to everyone else, he's dead. Jesus made him alive. He jumped down and went to him. And he said, that day, half I give to the poor. Everyone I've wronged, I give back four times. Jesus says, salvation has come to this man's house. There's Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. You must understand, the people of Israel can't stick the guy. They don't like him. He has nothing except that tax collector's booth. He has nothing except that little cash cow right there. Jesus says to him, leave that, follow me. He got up and he followed. It cost this young man everything, but he got 3.5 years to walk with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He got to write a book of the Bible. He is honored forever in heaven. He left what he thought was everything. It was nothing compared to what he got. He saw it, he left it, and he followed. That's a disciple. And he had no guarantees he's going to be a disciple. He had no guarantees he's going to write a book. He has no guarantees he's one of the 12. He's just a man Jesus took an interest in. What have you done with the interest Jesus took in you? Have you said, I'll follow? And I'm telling you now, and listen to me, some of you. Jesus did not speak to him, and Matthew got up and said, I'm going to do this because I want a life of significance. I don't think he had a clue what it's going to be. Stop thinking it's all about you. I'm following because I want my life to count. I know I said it, but I'm saying your life needs significance. Give it to something that counts, but don't look to be significant. No, I've got to go, Butch. God's got stuff in my life. God is going to put you on the shelf until you die to that nonsense. And you'll get frustrated like an old steam engine. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. He'll just wait. Have you ever noticed God is exceptionally patient? Hey? There's God who invented seasons. Just leave that aside. Follow me, told him. Matthew got up and followed. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said, it's not the health you need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. Jesus doesn't feed them on a little spoon. Go learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Gives the scriptures right back and say, hey, you know that Bible you have in your hand? Go and read the thing. Go and make it make sense to you. Well, I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. First two little introductory points right in the beginning, just there. That's where we are tonight. Page one, just there. First point I want to make. When it comes to disciple making, when Jesus has called you, you need an immediate response. There's no negotiation. There's an immediate response. In the words of that song, my feet were made for walking. The boots, I know, but still. My feet were made for walking. Walking's what they'll do. How's the rest go? Yeah. Walk all over you, but we're not that part. The point is just an immediate response. And I want to tell you, the Bible says keep in step with the Spirit. I want to tell you, from the second you start following, you better carry on. That's how momentum's built. You don't sit down. You carry on. So that's the first thing I want to say, immediate response. Number two, a focus on the sick, a focus on the unhealthy. I want you to notice that part of disciple making isn't to learn a whole lot. You got to see right here, the very first thing Jesus does when he calls Matthew is he goes to his friends and he says, I want you to catch the heart of disciple making. The heart of disciple making is we spend time with people who need it. Don't exclude your worldly friends. Minister to them. Every Sunday, every meeting we have, three times on a Sunday, are there any visitors? They can't only by coming past or looking on the internet. They need to be invited by their friends who are still in their lives but not being influenced by them. That's why we talk about non-negotiables. I'm going to go influence my friends. I'm going to sit in a pub for 6 months. No, you freak. You maintain your friendships, but you keep your passion for Jesus stronger. Jesus called you to follow. He told you, follow, and you're following. And in the following, you go and eat at the tax collector. You go eat at the sinner's house. But the reason you go eat there is to bring good news. Because they're sick and they need a doctor. Not just to go and fellowship and talk rubbish and throw your testimony away. It's to be in there and to be the salt and to be the light where it needs to be. Today, in this day, I didn't put a single light on. It doesn't need it. But when I'm at night and it's dark, the light dispels the darkness. So I'm invited into dark places, and I let my light shine. Because I'm concerned with those who are in darkness, who need the light. They're sick and they need a doctor. And the first thing God is showing Matthew, when you follow me, I want you to know, boy, we're going to be with those who need us. And I'm going to talk, can you believe it? I got 9 points just on my semi-introduction before page one. We're in it. I'm trying to show you what Jesus says is important for a disciple maker. Number one is immediate response. Do not ever lose the skill of when Jesus says something, you do it immediately. Take it to him. This world will throw things at you. I'm going to say what I say and not say it so it's vague and you don't understand where it's coming from. But an invitation came this last week to pack up and go to the States, all expenses paid, and start a church. Fully paid for. You can join the chicken run. Out of here. Fully paid for. All I've got to do is say yes. How long do you think we contemplate such a decision? Under 3 seconds. And in the 3 seconds, you're formulating your no. How do you do it without offending? Because when Jesus said follow, he did not call me right now for a course correction. Take it to me. He says, no, I follow. Immediate response, not to somebody. An immediate response to what God himself is saying. Because I'm going to stand before him one day for what he said, not what anybody else said, and not what they offered. And so will you. You can justify it any way you like, but I assure you, you will stand before him. The books will be written about what you were meant to do. And some will come and say, Lord, in that day, look what I did do. So don't give a continental about what you did do. What did I tell you to do? You surrendered my lordship for what you did and thought what you did would please me enough to get in and get all your rewards. This was not about me, it was about you. And you justified it. But we ate with you. We ate in your streets. We walked with you. I don't know you. I don't know you. Do you know how many Christians there are justifying everything to do what they want to do? Then they get to the other side and, oh, God, help me. I want to tell you, and I want to tell you clearly. Matthew was involved in his own life, his own security at the tax collector's booth, where God called him from it. This thing is irritating me. My delicate ears. Who preached here this morning? Kurt's a small guy. I bet he's got big ears. Immediate response followed by, I need to give you a heart for the sick and the broken. Be in environments where you sit with people and you just watch them. It's amazing what you learn by just watching. Just observing, looking for opportunities. And I tell you, God gives you somebody and you jump in there with a word from God. You live your life. You set an example. You set a life for others to follow. And when God opens a door and you start to see someone who's sick, you see, we know everyone's sick who doesn't, but there are those who are sick who think they're healthy. Now you keep preaching to them. They're going to look at you like, what's wrong with you? I've got a beautiful life. I don't need you. You know, when I got saved, it was a conviction of sin that got me saved. I didn't have issues. I'm at varsity. I'm living my dream. I'm studying law. I'm playing rugby. I'm doing other stuff. I'm not in any trouble. My heart's not broken. I don't need God. I need more money so I can have more fun. And I get a conviction of sin on a Friday night. I don't know what to do with it. And someone who my sister had been praying with for me for 6 months just opened a channel of communication. And I was sick, but I thought I was healthy. Then I was sick and I knew I was sick. And every sick person knows where the doctor is. Every sick person knows where the doctor is. They will, when they're sick in their souls, they will find that person whose light has shone. And they'll come to you when you just let your light shine. It's the sick who need a doctor. I'm telling you this. Go and learn what it means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Stop sacrificing yourself. Stop this. I'm asking for mercy. I'm asking you to care. I'm asking you to put yourself in the place where you care. I've not come to call the righteous but sinners. I cannot get past this tonight. There's more I wanted to say. I'll just say one more thing and I've got to, which is maybe point three. I'll see if I can get there. Most of you know that 2 days ago, Alistair passed away, right? Alistair McDougall. Friday. So myself and Graham go see him on Wednesday. and Melody and Vanessa. On Thursday, Graham and I go, spend time with him. Who walked in with us on that day? It was just us, hey? And his wife, Linda. And Linda's daughter. You know what, correct me if I'm wrong, the discussion we have around that time. Here's Alistair, we didn't even know it. He's got 24 hours to live. What is the discussion we're having? Because he's still talking. We're talking about a pump, am I right? A pump for the gardens at the squatter camp. How Nedbank's going to keep helping this particular fund. How we're going to do this. Down to his last, all this man can think about is, how do we further what God's called us to do? Not 1 ounce of feeling sorry for himself. Not 1 ounce, a disciple of the Lord Jesus Christ. Excited by it. Passionate. 24 hours later, you know that king he was serving? That king welcomed him. That king welcomed him. And I'm telling you right now, when Jesus took one look at Alistair McDougall, he said, well done. You good and faithful servant. You know what? He reached the end of his faith. He reached the goal of his faith. He finished his race. He had done everything he could for the sake of the king and his kingdom. And that for me is called normal Christianity. Where your life counts for the sake of others. Because when Jesus said follow, you followed. And when he said it's the sick who need a doctor, you said yes. Yes. And I want to be a mercy giver. I want to call those who need Jesus Christ. Giving a lesson to Matthew. Next thing, I know I'm repetitive. Then John's disciples came and asked him, how is it that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast? Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he's with them? The time will come and the bridegroom will be taken from them, then they'll fast. What was he talking about? His own death, we know that. And by the way, with today being Palm Sunday, most theologians are in agreement, most Bible teachers are in agreement, that because there were two Sabbaths on this particular year, it's more than probable Jesus was betrayed Wednesday night, crucified Thursday, that he spent 3 days and three nights, according to Jonah, in the tomb to wake up on Sunday, just so you know. But Jesus said a time will come when they will mourn, but it's not right now. When I'm with you, you need to celebrate, you need to rejoice. You see, the problem is what's going on here. The guests of the bridegroom, how can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he's with them? Just a question, how many of you have been to a wedding? All of you, I presume, unless you're that disappointed. Well, you can come to mine. Okay, if you've never been to a wedding, I'm inviting you to mine. Not you lot watching. You lot. All right, I'll invite you. And I want to tell you this, when you go to a wedding and you hang around with the bridegroom, do you know that everyone's pretty happy? They're celebrating. The issue is joy. John, the disciple of Jesus, began his gospel, his message, with a call to repentance. It was fresh. No one had done what John was doing. Everybody came to be baptized by John at the Jordan. He was revolutionary in his theology, revolutionary in his model. He threatened Pharisees. You whitewashed tombs. Who told you to repent? You nest of vipers. You dead people. He had a go at them like nothing. John had a go at the religious establishment. Fresh. By this time, what did John's disciples do? They are no longer confronting the Pharisees. They're going to the followers of Jesus and they're identifying with the Pharisees. It doesn't take long before your freshness becomes old. It's what happens here. How come we and the Pharisees are fasting, but yours aren't? The real question is to those disciples, why have you lost your joy? When you're told to follow, when you go minister to the sick, your testimony remains one of joy. Jesus said, how can they mourn when they're with the bridegroom? For goodness sake, when you're with the bridegroom, you're celebrating. Some of us have lost the celebration. That's why I said to Tian a few weeks ago, we need far more praise, far more exuberance back in the church. Every CD you buy, they're so depressed, I want to cry in worship. What happened to, this is the day, this is the day that the Lord has made. We will rejoice. No, it's now, it's, Oh, I look into my deepest, very soul. And in that I find the worst. I'm like, shut up. Why are they fasting and mourning and you aren't? Because the bridegroom, and I want to tell you this. The time's coming when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they'll fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. For the patch pulls away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, the wineskins will be ruined. No! You put new wine into new wineskins and both are preserved. In this joy of this message is the receiving of Jesus, the new wine, and he wants to come into your life and make you consistently a new, fresh, flexible wineskin. Some of us have forgotten we're supposed to be growing. We're supposed to be flexible. We have settled into certain behavioral and theological patterns, and we're stuck. And then others start to move into freshness, and what's the first thing we say? This can't be God. Why can't it be God? Because it doesn't look like what we do. Jesus says, "You, how do you keep a fresh wineskin? How do you embrace new wine? You keep an attitude of joy. Because when you're joyful, you're open, you're happy, you're celebrating with a bridegroom, and you're not the flipping bridegroom, and it's not your wedding. So you arrive, and the bridegroom says, let's do this. You don't stand up and say, well, I just want to tell you, protocol normally dictates that one doesn't do this now. Try that at my wedding. I tell you where to jump off. Because I tell you something, when I marry, I'm going to celebrate. And he is looking at this bride, and he is celebrating. He has paid the price. It's done. It's finished. And he wants us to live with an incredible sense of joy. He wants us to live with an incredible sense of life. And we walk around looking half dead and half baked, wondering why isn't the world impressed with this gospel?